party here. Hoover called J. Edgar Hoover called MLK the most dangerous man in America, right? Mm. Yeah.
The most dangerous man in America.
Yeah.
Nonviolent and still the most dangerous man in America.
Indeed, yeah. Not the mafiosa who were hitting right and left. So you've been talking about the Fanon thing. That's not until the end of the month, is it?
Yeah, yeah. Fanon is
end
later.
End of next month, yeah. I don't anymore, I regret to say. All right, what do we got today?
Glenn Ford.
Actually, Glenn Ford was at a conference in Philly this week, and apparently he's a bit tired. So I've got some Mumia Abu-Jamal, and it's a very pertinent one because it's about the situation of Reverend Pinckney in St. Joseph, Michigan, one of the many communities that have been taken over by these unelected executives. We have this state of emergency in Flint with all this lead poisoning going on. And they're actually sending out bills to people. They're billing people right now for the water that they can't drink because it's poisonous. Well, the backstory on it has been held up pretty well by Amy Goodman, but there is one point that I think that ought to be emphasized is that this law that allows the takeover at the state level of communities when they're insolvent or they make the case, it was passed once, and it was overturned by a statewide referendum in Michigan, and then they passed it again, and they put it under the category of a appropriations bill, which are immune to referendum and recall in Michigan. So this is the context that I haven't heard at all on public media, and Amy Goodman actually did a lot of good work on it, but that point hasn't been emphasized, that this was a struggle all the way along, this takeover of these supposedly insolvent communities when they're insolvent because the state aid was cut back to a large extent.
Well, you know, one of the things that it makes me think about is when we did some study on this, the American Legislative Exchange Commission, this ALEC group.
They're
because what
it.
You're saying is that at the state level, they have targeted hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars at the state level. They're not even focusing on the federal level. They took over Wisconsin with Walker. They bought the election here with Rahner. Right. And that agenda is the American Legislative Exchange Commission agenda. You need to look them up, Google them,
right.
Understand that they're spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars whining and dining, 99% Republican.
And it's all educational, and it doesn't have to be revealed to the public. And we got...
I looked at their website yesterday, and you'll notice they used to have those dummy bills that they would give to those nice Republican legislators.
Right. To the dummy legislators?
They took them all down.
Yeah.
They don't have them on their site anymore.
You have to email for them, I guess. They don't want to be seen like they're the ones that are pulling the strings because, you know, they are. Thanks. Have a great day. Don't fall off the horse. Here, as I mentioned, is Mumia Abu-Jamal. And Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon, I think, are both exhausted from their conference in Philly. I expect to see some good results. They do have a half hour or an hour program, and I was thinking about excerpting a little bit of it. But I got some great stuff about the coup in Honduras. It's generally sort of an international issue. But also Robert Perry again on Libya and some of the email dumps from Secretary of State HRC. I don't call her Hillary because I'm not really on a first name basis with her, so that's what that comes from. But I suggest you hang around for that. It's quite engaging. You might say I'm Hillary bashing. Well, I think it's stuff that you don't hear other places. You hear a lot of discourse about vote for a woman, like Margaret Thatcher might have been a good idea to vote for. But you hear a lot of fake issues and fake things about Benghazi. Apparently the film 13 Hours is being screened by Trump in Iowa. Instead of having to talk so much, he's sponsoring this film screening. It's a Michael Bay shoot 'em up retelling of history. It purports to be accurate. It's been shot down in a number of different ways. But I wonder whether maybe he had some financial backing to it, or who actually did back the film. Not that I'm defending Hillary, but I think she should be attacked for the right things. They keep calling that place that was attacked in Benghazi a diplomatic outpost. It was a CIA station, and they were doing lots of nefarious stuff there, stuff that you didn't think that Ambassador Stevens would cotton to, but, well, we will never know his side of the story, right? All right. Here's Mumia Abu-Jamal and the regular feature Breaking the Sound Barrier with Amy Goodman. She's got something on. I haven't actually previewed it yet, but it's a bit of a reflection on the State of the Union address, which I don't have anywhere else in today's program. So, except I don't watch it. I read the text afterwards generally, look at some of the highlights, because you got to walk the walk, not just talk the talk, it seems to me.
Free Reverend Pinckney. Reverend Edward Pinckney is the kind of preacher that Martin King would admire. Rather than build a mansion and live like a prince, Pinckney has, for years, advocated for his community, fighting for water rights, fair elections, and social justice for the people of Benton Harbor, Michigan. Because of his political activities, he's been targeted by the government, tried by the Michigan political machine, tried before an all-white jury, and convicted of allegedly altering 5 petition dates. Incredibly, Reverend Pinckney is facing 10 years in prison. Remember the petitions? They were recall petitions of Benton Harbor's mayor, a politician owned and operated by the Whirlpool Corporation, the real owner of the town. For speaking out against this corporate political domination, Pinckney became the target of the legal system. At trial, no one even claimed Reverend Pinckney altered anything. He turned in hundreds of petitions against Whirlpool's puppet mayor. That was crime enough, apparently. As Reverend Pinckney approaches his second year in Marquette Prison, his support is growing across the country as he fights his appeals. The call to free Reverend Pinckney is growing. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, I said St. Joseph, Michigan. It's actually a twin city arrangement, St. Joseph being the more African-American community. So I dare say he probably spent more of his time there, but getting in trouble with Maytag and their mayor. We have our imbroglio here with the governor and his turnaround agenda that he insists in holding everything hostage, including the care of some of the most vulnerable people in the society. It's worth screaming about. But in Michigan, and they have this ALEC-inspired proposal for privatization, et cetera, and state-level takeover of all these communities. There was a piece, like I said, on Democracy Now! About it, and there's only one of these communities that's been taken over that is actually majority white, and it's a very impoverished community. So, as the guy said, it's race and class. But something like, I've heard the figure as high as 60% of the minorities that live in Michigan are basically disenfranchised. All right, I go to Amy Goodman next. I may replay an older segment from Bruce Gagnon, who is out in Maine, but a pretty international guy. He's just been back from South Korea, where he was there at the time when the new Aegis class South Korean battle cruiser with probably ABMs on it showed up and docked there for the first use of this military base that nobody talks about. And but I probably won't have time to get to it, as it is I'm running on a little bit. I'm going to replay a little bit of my intervention. I played last week Sundayata, Chajwas, and Belden Fields. Good health to you, Belden, if you're listening or your friends are listening. You can convey regards. He just had some stent surgery, so I don't think he's disinclined for me to mention that. Belden Fields and then James Kilgore, whose book I cite and learned a lot from, even though I haven't read the whole thing cover to cover yet. So probably won't get to the issue about North Korea. Maybe I'll see if I can get something on about that. Bruce on Facebook did point out that there's a Reuters editorial suggesting that North Korea has made an overture. They're seen as being petulant, and but they said nuclear tests could end if there was actually a peace treaty, and if these massive, twice a year, I think they are, one of them is huge in the spring, joint maneuvers, war games are suspended. I have no brief for his totalitarian government, but I think the U.S.'s own role in the situation ought to be examined a little closer, and it certainly isn't by mainstream media. Flashpoints, which is where we're going to for both the piece about Honduras, Adrian Pines, and Robert Perry of Consortium News. I'm going to put on the Adrian Pines, it's nearly 25 minutes long, about Honduras, and it impinges on a lot of different issues, including the continual problem with these unaccompanied minors and other people fleeing, women and children fleeing Honduras. But here's Breaking the Sound Barrier with Amy Goodman.
The Stateless and the State of the Union. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Barack Obama delivered his final State of the Union address Tuesday night before an almost full joint session of Congress. Almost full because of the empty seat next to First Lady Michelle Obama. The White House stated, "We leave one seat empty in the First Lady's State of the Union guest box for the victims of gun violence who no longer have a voice, because they need the rest of us to speak for them, to tell their stories, to honor their memory," unquote. That symbol, the empty chair, creates a moment to reflect on who else wasn't seated in that august gallery in the Capitol, like the undocumented immigrants rounded up in the New Year's raids by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE. Hundreds, if not thousands, the number isn't known, of people, mostly from the Central American nations of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, have been arrested in raids across the country. Entire families, single mothers with children, and individuals, many of whom fled for their lives from violence in their home countries, now are being swept up by armed federal agents and prepared for deportation. I asked Maryland Congresswoman Donna Edwards, who's now running for the U.S. Senate, about the ICE raids.
I think it's irresponsible, this sort of extreme enforcement in communities that in the congressional district that I represent is causing so much great fear in communities, children not going to school, people not going to work, being afraid to be seen and visible in their communities.
Congressmember Edwards' sentiments have been echoed on the campaign trail by both Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The raids have provoked protests across the country. Last Friday, seven people were arrested in New York City in front of the local ICE headquarters, chaining themselves together and blocking traffic. Among those arrested was Claudia Palacios. Her story is remarkable. She was born in Texas and served for 5 years in the U.S. Marines, with 2 years in Okinawa and several years around the world deployed with a Marine Expeditionary Unit. Even though she served her country honorably, this U.S.-born military veteran has documentation issues of her own. Her mother was undocumented. Like many pregnant women in her situation, she was afraid to go to the hospital. Claudia was born with the help of a midwife in a trailer park. It was the midwife who signed her birth certificate.
That birth certificate was recognized by the military in order for me to join the service,
said Claudia Palacios on Democracy Now!
Once I was an active duty service member, I applied with the Department of State for a passport, and they failed to recognize my birth certificate.
Now out of the Marines without her U.S. military ID badge and no passport, she said,
"I'm basically stateless. I can't leave my country."
The empty chair was on the First Lady's right. On her left sat decorated war veteran Oscar Vasquez. The same White House press statement that described the symbolism of the chair said Vasquez, quote, "came to the United States as a child in search of a better life. From age 12, when he moved from Mexico to Phoenix, Arizona, Oscar excelled in the classroom. But without legal status, he couldn't secure a job to provide for his new wife and newborn child," the statement said. After receiving a green card, his biography continued, "Oscar enlisted in the Army to serve the country he loves and calls home. Oscar served one tour in Afghanistan and is now a proud U.S. citizen." Claudia Palacios was not satisfied.
I think it's a mockery to have him be a guest, an honored guest at the State of the Union, and then have not even initiate the conversation of immigration and how we are going to deal with this, or how we're going to create sanctuaries for people that are being targeted.
The victims of gun violence deserve a seat. They deserve to have their stories told, and the president is to be commended for taking that stand. But the people in this country who fled gun violence, whether from Central America or Syria or Afghanistan or Iraq, they too deserve a seat and a place of sanctuary. That will make the State of the Union strong. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
In the second half hour, we'll return to Honduras, specifically one of the places where many are fleeing from. I've heard various figures about how many people have actually been sent back, but the threat of being sent back just heightens the insecurity of these folks in a place where, well, I'll go into it a little earlier in the introduction, but where the bodies are buried. One of the issues of the Zelaya coup was the Palmarosa, I believe it was called, base. I did fly into Tegucigalpa once, and the airport was frightening. It was an absolutely short runway, and there was a sheer cliff at the end of it or something. I don't know. It was that's the way I remember it anyway. But they wanted to take over this facility and give the Americans another place to be, a smaller place. It seems to me that it's likely there are body dumps from the Central American War under the Reagan era. It might still be there. I don't know. There certainly is a lot of that happening. Forensic anthropology through all the dirty wars in Latin America. And the Honduran one was pretty much owned by the U.S. when Negroponte was down there. But we'll return to that in the second hour. And how I'm going to tie this together, the Legal Reform Forum. I was just talking to Aaron and Carol, our state rep. She sponsored this forum a couple Thursdays ago now, and I'm going to be going in to work with some people at UPTV to see whether we can fix it up enough to present it as a video. It should run about an hour and a half with the Q&A. Actually, the Q&A was most of it. She's doing another one. It's already into next month, February 2nd, and it's about what's being called the LaSalle Street Tax, variously called the Tobin tax, for a rather conservative economist at University of Chicago who was one of the earlier espousers of a transaction tax, LaSalle Street being where a lot of the nodes of electronic money transfer go around. And sponsored by Carol Ammon's Alliance for Community Services, who are the people that are allied to try to do something about the state budget, and Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Again, there'll be more time to find out about that as it's the first couple days of February. Don't have the MLK announcements in front of me, but again, Carol is giving the keynote tomorrow. I believe that's the one that's at Krannert, but maybe I should have something in front of me on that. All right, let's hear my intervention. As I mentioned, I played longer interventions by Belden Fields and Sunday Adil Chajwa and James Kilgore, and I didn't play my own. I was towards the end, and I did try to be very succinct, but I'm going to blow my own horn here. I thought this was good contribution, and regrettably, the police chief of Urbana and Champaign were both gone by this time, because I sort of was sending out the message to them, so just trying to make it echo around the radio.
Welcome back to these airs.
Drama of the moment. It seems to me, I'm glad to hear that I was the impatient one about crisis intervention, because it's a scandal. And what is a scandal is that downstate communities are going to Chicago to get their training. I think that's ridiculous. And they should go to Memphis, which has an award-winning program, or find some people that can do it locally. But the other thing, you always hear about invest in the communities instead of in the jails. There is something called the Justice Reinvestment Program, and Illinois and states like Maryland and Missouri have never been enrolled in it. It actually does divert some money that's used to incarcerate people. I learned this from James Kilgore's really good book, and I don't know why states like Illinois and Maryland, nominally Democratic controlled, do not have any involvement in this program, because it really is investing in the communities and not incarceration. It has some problems, but it's really the direction to go, and thanks.
Certainly, be open to hearing some information about it if you've got it.
Well, I posted the link to the CUPJ. I think I posted it to the event. What I did post to the Citizens for Peace and Justice Facebook page is a Dropbox link to the audio from the event. So if you were wondering what happened, it's a little raw, and hopefully I'll use it to find the bad spots and make the video even better. But anyway, that's thanks for forbearing that. But now we'll get to what I've gotten from Pacifica's audio port service. It's available also on SoundCloud. This is a replay of the Adrian Pines interview, and this one was from Thursday, I guess, of this week. Robert Perry. I'm going to play Robert Perry first. I was talking about the Benghazi movie and how Trump seems to be screening it at his events, or making his event a screening of a film that is pretty much a polemicist, Michael Bay political, purportedly sort of a docudrama, as it were. It's as probably as much of one as Zero Dark Thirty was. Robert Perry of Consortium News, I go to him a lot. I think he's brilliant. He's one of the guys that broke the Iran-Contra connection and the drugs for drugs sales for Contras in the that era of the Reagan Central American Wars, if you will. And this segment runs 17 minutes, and then I've got a 24-minute interview with Adrian Pine, so we'll see how we can do with this. Labor Hour is coming up straight away.
Hearings held. Hillary Clinton came out of those hearings like a shining knight, unscathed. Well, there are more emails. There was a dump over the Christmas and New Year's break, I guess, to get it out of the way and have as few people as possible see it. But Robert Perry saw it, and he joins us now from the Washington, D.C. area. Robert Perry, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And, well, this is, now you've written this article, What Hillary Knew About Libya, and it's based on this dump of emails. Could you set up the scene?
Well, sure. These emails that I'm writing about were written by Sidney Blumenthal, one of her sort of private aides. Sidney had been a journalist for the Washington Post and the New Republic. He went to work in the Clinton White House during the 1990s and became a real defender and advocate for both Bill and Hillary Clinton. He was a very aggressive advisor to her campaign in 2008, but was essentially blackballed by the Obama administration. Because of some of the hard feelings that went back to that campaign. But he remained a close advisor to Secretary of State Clinton in the first 4 years of the Obama administration, and was providing her with some very interesting private intelligence. Blumenthal had developed some good ties to the various intelligence communities, especially in Europe, and so he was reporting on things that people were thinking behind the scenes. Particularly the French, in regard to Libya, as the crisis in 2011 gets worse. So he was providing her with both rumors, things that could be used against Gaddafi, stories that really have not really panned out. Particularly, there was one story about that Gaddafi had given out Viagra to his troops to get them to rape women more frequently. It turned out it was something that was actually raised in the UN by then UN Ambassador Susan Rice, but was widely discredited, and that apparently came in part from one of these emails. But more interestingly, Blumenthal also was telling Secretary Clinton how the French were really viewing what was going on in Libya.
And, well, in terms of, just to stay with the Viagra for a moment, it was a major rumor, but you've got the U.S. representative at the United Nations bringing it up?
Right. Ambassador Rice brought it up during a closed session of the Security Council, in which there was a debate about Libya. She was apparently trying to say that the rebels that the United States were giving support to were morally superior to Gaddafi's people. And so she cited this rather spurious rumor about Viagra being distributed as one of the examples of why Gaddafi was worse.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about these substantial emails. What else came out? It was clear that the information coming from France was very sort of leaning towards their policies and their interests in Libya.
Right. According to Blumenthal's memos, French President Sarkozy was not really interested particularly in any human rights concerns. He was concerned about maintaining French influence in Africa. Obviously, France had been a colonial power in large parts of Africa and remained important to those countries. The French franc was often used as a benchmark by their currencies. And this was important to France economically and geopolitically. So Gaddafi was seen as a threat to that. According to one of the memos, Gaddafi had amassed 143 tons of gold and a similar amount of silver, and had planned to use that to create an African currency that would have freed up some of the African states from their dependence on France in particular, but the West in general. And so Gaddafi's main offense, according to this account of Sarkozy's motives, was to make sure that Gaddafi could not provide this ability, using his oil wealth, to free these African nations from their dependency on France and in Europe and the West in general.
Now, the way this was presented by the United States and by Hillary Clinton excluded some crucial material in terms of Gaddafi and the role that he might be playing in restraining the ISIS types.
Right. Well, Gaddafi's main point was that this uprising against him was being driven by Islamic fundamentalist the terrorist groups, and in fact, even at the time, there had been a study done by the U.S. War Institute at West Point, which found that proportionately more fighters, Islamic fighters against the United States and Iraq, came from the eastern section of Libya than any other country. The greater number came from Saudi Arabia, but proportionate to population, the largest number came from that eastern Benghazi area of Libya. So this was known to U.S. intelligence at the time. But when Gaddafi said that he needed to crack down on these extremists back in 2011, that was then cited by Secretary Clinton and others in the Obama administration as a reason to have a responsibility to protect operation. They exaggerated what Gaddafi was actually saying to claim that he was trying to commit genocide. And based on these theories that Samantha Power, who was then a senior advisor of the National Security Council, had put forward, the U.S. government and the civilized world had to step in and protect these innocent civilians. Now, Gaddafi never really planned to engage in genocide. There was never any evidence of that. And there really was a serious problem with these terror groups associated with Al-Qaeda and others trying to gain a foothold in eastern Libya. So the purpose of there was always a propaganda element in the way Clinton and the U.S. government pitched the intervention in Libya.
We're speaking with Robert Perry. He is the editor-founder of ConsortiumNews.com. He's got a piece up there, What Hillary Knew About Libya. And we're talking about the piece based on emails that were released over the New Year's break, sort of meant, I guess, to disappear into the abyss. Tell us about R2P. What was that about?
Well, R2P has become the new excuse to go to war. Basically, in Washington, you have the neoconservatives, and you have the liberal interventionists, and they are very much sort of joined at the hip. They offer somewhat different excuses for going to war. The neocons will say, we're doing it because we want to promote democracy. liberal interventionists will say we're doing it because we want to protect human rights. And so what they end up doing is creating these conflicts that end up killing many more people and causing much more damage and destruction than whatever they were trying to stop. And we saw this in 2003 when the neocons claimed they were going to make things better for Iraq, and we saw how that turned out. And then in the case of Libya, which is was driven more by the liberal interventionists, although with support of the neocons, that was to basically protect the people of Libya from Gaddafi. And what we've seen since Gaddafi's overthrow and then his torture murder in October of 2011, we've seen Libya descend into anarchy, where the Islamic State and other radical groups have seized more and more territory. There have been mass executions and other atrocities. So this idea that is sold to the American people that we're doing these things for these grand, wonderful, noble motives are often disproven by the results. But what's interesting about one of these emails in particular is that it also explains what was really behind it. Blumenthal, for instance, describes to Secretary Clinton in one of the emails, he goes through what France's motives are for joining this. He says, first, they have a desire to gain greater control of Libya oil production. They want to increase French influence in northern Africa. They want to improve the internal political situation for Sarkozy in France. They're trying to provide the French military with an opportunity to reassert its position in the world. And they want to address the concerns of Sarkozy's people that Gaddafi has long-term plans to supplant France as the dominant power in Francophone Africa. So in other words, behind these pretty words about R2P, responsibility to protect, or spreading democracy, there are more realistic geopolitical, realpolitik, if you will, ideas that are really driving these operations.
And was there anything in those emails about Clinton's response to what was going on the ground that we should know?
Well, these emails I was looking at came from a more or less earlier part of 2011, March, April of 2011. Obviously, things get further; they go further along. There is a point, actually, with some earlier emails that were released, in which Blumenthal suggests to Clinton after Gaddafi's government falls, but before he's captured, that she should jump in and take credit for it. And he has this, he says, brava, I guess that's plural for bravo, brava, for your great handling of this, and you have to be the one to sort of develop this, seize control and be the one to take credit. And one of her advisors in another email says, well, this, we'll call this the Clinton Doctrine, what happened in Libya. And, of course, then Obama sort of steals the show, goes out on the White House lawn and announces the great success of having overthrown Gaddafi. And then in October, when Gaddafi is finally captured, basically he's sodomized with a knife and tortured, and then
on camera, he was murdered on camera.
Right. So, quite a grisly scene. Mrs. Clinton, at the time, Secretary Clinton, was giving an interview with one of the networks, and she responds to this news she giggles literally, and she says, "We came, we saw, he died," and she laughs and claps her hands. So I think when you see that context, and you put it against some of these other motives for why Gaddafi was actually overthrown, he was trying to create a situation where the African states would be more independent, would have greater economic independence, and could be freed from some of the IMF pressures and other things that they've had to deal with. And you put this into that context, and then you look at what happened subsequent, which is that we still, to this date, have a situation where various warlords and militias are running parts of Libya, while the most extreme Islamic terrorists are grabbing more and more territory and indeed trying to seize some of the oil fields. So the war has gotten much worse. The people of Libya have ended up losing whatever wealth they had. The opportunity for that Central Africa, which where Gaddafi was trying to build ties, that has all been essentially stripped away. And the winners, I guess, if there are any, might be the French and some European powers that are able to, in some sense, maintain their control over parts of Africa. But it has not been particularly good for the people of Libya. and not good for the people of Africa. And frankly, there's been a lot of death and destruction that could have been avoided.
And it does appear to be almost a mirror of what happened in Iraq with the deposing of Saddam Hussein, but just a bit to a bit of a smaller degree. But it's the same end to the overthrow policy, which is total, a situation which is out of control and makes life more dangerous for everybody in the world.
Well, regime change, which has been sort of the neocon method of choice, which really you start seeing emerging in the 1990s, where they begin to they basically reject the idea of the Oslo Accords in 1995. After Rabin is killed, the neocons throw their support behind Netanyahu and this more aggressive approach in Israel, and they actually go and advise Netanyahu, people like Richard Perle and others, that they should just they should abandon negotiations and go for regime change as the way to sort of get rid of troublesome governments in the regions. And Iraq was always at the top of the list. Syria was at the top of the list. Iran, Libya was sort of a sideshow in that sense. But you have this idea that instead of negotiating or working things through diplomacy, you simply bomb people and give ultimatums and overthrow governments. And the thinking apparently is you put in some compliant client, someone like Yeltsin was in Russia. Chalabi was supposed to be the person they picked for Iraq. But often things don't work out that way. These things are much more dangerous and unpredictable. So not even these masters of the universe, the neocons, get the results that they seem to want. But they end up with massive amounts of chaos. They are not held accountable. And then they move on to the next one.
Robert Perry, who's on the list. And he could have given the liberal humanitarian intervention of the 90s, which was the Balkan experience. Now, Lessons from Kosovo is Chomsky's short book on that, and it's a masterpiece. It seems to me it's subtitled Towards New Military Humanitarian Intervention or something like that. Well, we're checking out, and I think it's one actually that's you can get at chomsky.info and find the whole thing, the whole text on the web, like Rethinking Camelot, which is also up there. And it's interesting to note that the KLA, the group that the CIA was training and backing in Kosovo, is finally coming up to trial for human rights violations, including organ harvesting from their victims at the time. There's also a story that came out in Holland, but not many other places, that the U.S. was recruiting jihadists to go and fight in the Balkans. And a lot of threads hang off of that. Anyway, that was not all of the interview with Perry. It's well worth your attention, and you can go to Consortium News and find the article that was based on. But I thought we should get at least the bulk of the Adrian Pines interview. She's out east, and I've heard her before. I've played her, not recently, but she's lived a fair amount in Honduras before and after the coup. And again, it's Dennis Bernstein holding down the interview seat on this one. And it's about, we'll start it right now. I was going to play a sample of Jackie Scott playing with Kilbourne Alley at their 14th anniversary party. She's back in town. They bring in these performers from out of town for pretty big parties. It's at the Iron Post, so it can't be that big. But anyway, that's my musical mention of the day. There's some other things going on, including trad jazz. Earlier in the evening at the same old watering hole, there were great big fun. Not traditional jazz in the sense of straight ahead jazz, but this is they play stuff from 1898 to 1930s. But here's Dennis Bernstein with Adrian Pines returning to the issue of Central Americans, refugees, U.S. complicity, the coup, and Hillary's role too. I called her Hillary. I should always say HRC.
She has spent a great deal of time in Honduras, a lot of time on a Fulbright scholarship, and she has been there before, during, and after the U.S., we have to say, U.S.-supported coup in Honduras. Professor Pine, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much for having me again, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Now, coming up right after this broadcast today is the president's last State of the Union speech, and he has been a very furious supporter, a really powerful supporter of free trade, various incarnations of free trade. I know that you being in Honduras have seen some of the impacts. There was a coup and then followed by this imposition of these extraordinarily draconian right-wing free trade policies that do not help the people of these struggling countries.
That's right, Dennis. Actually, I mean, the free trade policies come both before and after the coup, but as you know, they really are exacerbated. And neoliberal policies in general, having to do with privatization, the destruction of the public sector, of unions, of healthcare, of education. But looking sort of more in the long term at the impacts of free trade legislation and agreements in Honduras, you could take, for example, its impact on healthcare, which has been devastating. Although Honduras never had a stellar healthcare system, it did have a public healthcare system that provided pretty good healthcare for working people, and a system called the Honduran Institute for Social Security, and that was a public system. One of the impacts of the coup was that there has been less regulation, which is something that free trade advocates call for. But what that meant is that the people who carried out the coup were able to take over the public institutes in charge of health and education and defund them in order to fund their own campaigns and enrich themselves. So the Honduran Institute for Social Security last year, it came out that the entire funding of the institute, many millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars had been sacked in order to pay for the presidential campaign of the current president and of his co-party members in the 2013 elections. And the current president has militarized the entire country. He's really created a dictatorship, and it's a dictatorship in favor of free trade and privatization, and at the expense of any semblance of a healthcare system in Honduras. So right now, Hondurans have nowhere to turn when they get sick. Even Hondurans in, relatively good professions, presumably the ones that have been previously guaranteed some sort of coverage, now really have nothing. And so Hondurans last year were marching out on the streets. They had a movement called the Indignados, the outrage movement, marching, demanding that the president step down. As of last June, as of the sixth anniversary of the military coup in 2009 that the current president and administration supported, they had counted that there were 3,000 additional deaths in the system, the IHSS system, as a result of the coffers being ransacked. And I know that I'm going on here, but even before the coup, I want to point out that free trade agreements had already drastically eroded the healthcare that was provided, and that's through CAFTA. And so one thing that agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA do is they really privilege the rights of corporations over any democratic rights of populations. And so in this case, CAFTA gave the right to U.S. pharmaceutical corporations to deny generic permissions for companies to, or for governments to provide generic drugs to their populations, which meant that Hondurans, to get access to flu medication or something like that, would have to pay prices that were even higher than what people in the U.S. would have to pay at salaries that are, well below poverty salaries. Honduras is an impoverished country. And so what that means is that with free trade agreements, people no longer have access to medication. Their health care is privatized. It goes downhill. And then with things like the military, the U.S., and in particular Hillary Clinton, supported military coup, they lose those human rights entirely.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Adrian Pine of the American University. We're talking about Honduras. We're talking about Honduras because for many reasons, but it's from Honduras that the majority of Central Americans are fleeing to the United States, and they're being brutalized when we get here. The current administration not only has been considered the deporter in chief, in other words, so many people deported in a very brutal way, another deportation planned by ICE beginning to be implemented. People are again in terror, but very little is said about what's causing people to leave and who is responsible. And that's why we have invited Professor Pine. She's also the author of Working Hard and Drinking Hard on Violence and Survival in Honduras. And as I said, she spent a lot of time there. I'm just like, one headline out of many reads, El Salvador and Honduras are locked in an unholy race for the world's highest homicide rate, with surging crime and drug violence across the region threatening to trigger an even larger surge of migrants seeking to get into the United States. You've been on the ground. You were on the ground before and after. Maybe you can give us a sense of what Zelaya was trying to do before he was deposed, clearly with the support of the U.S. government, either before, during, and or after. Say something about what was beginning to happen there, and then how violent it is in terms of what it really looks like on the ground there.
Sure, Dennis. President Zelaya began his term as something of a moderate liberal, but really ended up going being pushed to the left toward more progressive politics by the social movements in Honduras that had a radically different vision of what security meant than the people who had been in power before him. So, you know, you've got these two visions of security that are diametrically opposed. One of them has to do with security in the sense of having the security to get education, to get health care, to have your own land to farm, you know, to have healthy water, healthy air. And the other security is a security based on fear, of the fear of gang members, a security to lock as many people up as possible so that you will be safe from violent people. And so one of them has, you know, is based on the analysis of threats, of potential threats as being really disparities of wealth and income, whereas the other one really labels the poor as the primary threat. And so, you know, Zelaya was going toward this trend happening throughout Latin America of countries, of people who have been, you know, saying, no, enough of this privatizing neoliberal model. What we really want is education. We want a right to eat. We want a right to health. We want a right to land. We want a right to water. And so Zelaya was taking small steps towards supporting that agenda, while at the same time still, you know, he was still very business friendly and, in fact, in many ways neoliberal. He was the one who passed CAFTA, after all. But even the small steps he was taking, like increasing the minimum wage and creating greater access to education and some pensions, they were enough of a threat to the establishment, to the wealthy in Honduras and international corporations, that they were willing to overthrow him to consolidate their hold on capital, really, in Honduras. And, you know, and since then, the security situation in terms of security, you know, of people being able to walk out on the streets and not get killed has just gone downhill. When I was living there in 2013, 2014 in the capital city of Tegucigalpa, I could hear gunshots every night from my house. You know, I learned to distinguish what a firecracker and a gunshot and a car backfiring sounded like, because I heard all three of those so much from my apartment. It's a terrifying situation to be in the midst of that kind of violence. And it was in 2010, I think, the first year that Honduras achieved the level of most murderous country in the world, according to the UN homicide statistics. And, you know, it's at a rate, it was sort of wavering between 80, 90 per 100,000 population, 80 or 90 homicides per 100,000 population, which is, it's hard to even fathom in the United States. You know, we're around 6 or 8, I think, depending on the year. In our worst cities, when we talk about the cities with the highest murder rate, they will sometimes get up to 50 per 100,000. So Honduras was well above that. Rather than responding with providing greater citizen security, job opportunities, education, what the Honduran administration has done post-coup and with full U.S. support is to militarize the country, and, you know, put military police on every corner. This has a terrorizing effect on the population, and it doesn't do anything to increase people's chances, to increase people's life chances. People are living in terror. Almost everybody I asked when I would give lectures, I would always ask how many of you have lost a loved one or family member to homicide. I would generally get between 70% and 100% of people raising their hands. So if you think about not just the homicide rate, but the impact that has on the population as a whole, which is all experiencing some kind of trauma, it's no surprise that so many people are desperate to come to the United States, knowing full well that on that journey they could get maimed, attacked, raped, or even killed, because that's how bad the situation is, thanks to the U.S. militarization, the U.S. economic policies, and the U.S. support of the military coup in 2009.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Adrian Pine, who knows a great deal about Honduras, has written about it extensively, was there studying in some of the most violent moments in the country, and has seen the transition pre-coup Zelaya and post-coup, and to the tragedy of it being one of the murder capitals, if not the murder capital, of the world, and clearly it has a lot to do with U.S. policy, which hasn't changed much, I'm afraid to say, since the passing of the Monroe Doctrine. I want to talk to you about the coup and the reasons that the U.S. apparently supported the coup. What do you think about the theory that the driving force, more than economic and free trade in terms of getting rid of Zelaya, was that the U.S. military and the Pentagon were really hell-bent on keeping a military base in Honduras, given that the trend in the region is to throw the freaking military out?
Well, certainly that played a role. I don't think there was any threat that the military was going to leave Honduras. In fact, Mel Zelaya himself approved new military installations, new U.S. military installations as president. But that said, this came on the heels of Correa, the president of Ecuador, refusing to renew a U.S. lease on the Manta base in Ecuador, and saying that only if he could open a base in Miami for Ecuador would he renew that lease. And so that was a real slap in the face for the U.S. military, which had counted on Ecuador as a regional hub. And so then with that, the importance of Honduras as a U.S. military base grew even stronger. So certainly U.S. military, I think plays a real role in the decision of various actors within the U.S. government to maintain or to support the Honduran coup in 2009.
What does, the United States government, what do they know about the violence and who's committing the violence in Honduras now, given this military presence that they have and this focus on the country? Or what do they know, and when have they known it, in terms of what is devastating the population, the drugs, and the way in which gangs have taken turns murdering human rights activists?
Yeah, I think, the talk, the popular talk that we often hear is that the gangs have gotten out of control. But really, if you look at the timing of the increase in violence, it corresponds directly with the coup, and in particular with the impunity that's afforded to the state agents who are carrying out violence, the military, the police, and now the military police as well, the impunity that's accorded them for the crimes against humanity that they carried out following the coup, and which have only really exacerbated since then. So, in the U.S., I think these actors, in terms of analyzing the violence that's going on in Honduras, it's perhaps even more important to talk about the state violence than about the gang violence, because, with the total breakdown of the legal and judicial system as a result of the coup, which cleansed the whole system of any lawyers and DAs who had supported who had opposed the coup. And this was, by the way, recently ruled, the Inter-American Human Rights Court recently ruled against the current Honduran administration for cleansing the judges, but they haven't done anything to reinstate them, the judges and DAs. So, you know, with the breakdown of the judicial system and with a total impunity accorded to the military and police, they're actively operating death squads within their ranks. What that has meant is that people within Honduras don't have any chance to get any sort of justice if an injustice is carried out against them. And, you know, they also see that the way that the government is operating is only through violence. That's their only source of power right now. And so what is the U.S. doing? It's sending more and more and more money to the military and the military police and the police, supposedly for training and even for human rights training. But the fact is that this money is a clear sign to those institutions that they have U.S. support, despite the fact that they're operating death squads, despite the fact that they're working directly in the service of people like the recently deceased Miguel Sacuse, but also, you know, his family and the corporations that he founded, who was responsible for the murder of over 100 peasant farmers on the north coast of Honduras, you know, whose land he was disputing.
Could you spell his name, please? Spell his name.
Yeah, so the last name is Sacuse, F-A-C-U-S-S-E. First name is Miguel. And actually, the minister, the foreign minister of Mel Zelaya, Patricia Rodas, was illegally kidnapped and taken out of the country on the day of the coup in Miguel Sacuse's plane. You know, to give you a sense of the impunity. Of course, nothing ever happened to him as a result of that. And he just consolidated his power and finances and ability to murder with impunity as a result of his support of the coup. And that's really emblematic of what the U.S. has been standing for in Honduras. They've been standing in support of wealthy oligarchs who get away with murder at every turn. And they've been supporting really what's a narco state right now, a state that's really run by drug money and its police and military function as cartels and have death squads. And it's worse than the 1980s by far, which is an era that, you know, is really famous for its atrocities under Negroponte and, you know, in the Cold War, sort of staging ground for the Contra war that was Honduras. And, you know, people were also being trained, you know, for the other wars in Central America.
I mean,
as well.
It really is amazing to think about that Honduras at one point was sort of referred to as a land-based U.S. battleship. Being used to to overthrow the Sandinista government and that policy devastated Honduras, and it seemed that there would be a tiny bit of recovery under Zelaya, you know, a recovery, if you will, from U.S. Monroe Doctrine policy. But here comes, and this is, I guess, what I want to talk to you about. Here, you know, people say, hey, the U.S. knew about the coup, they had pre-knowledge about the coup, Hillary Clinton supported the coup. What's your best understanding of the role of the United States government and of Hillary Clinton? Because everybody's talking about Obama, you know, Trump, forgive me, for his, you know, deport them all, build the most beautiful wall that you ever saw stuff. That's a threat, but the Obama administration with Hillary Clinton, formerly the Secretary of State, has been devastating to the Central American community. Vicious. Your
That's
thoughts
right.
on that?
I mean, the impacts of the Obama administration's policy have indeed been just atrocious for Central Americans, in particular from the Northern Triangle. And, you know, Hillary Clinton openly took credit for the coup, staying in power, staying in place in her memoir, Hard Choices.
She certainly engineered enter Oscar Arias, who's supporting the U.S. government, to deliberate whether it was a coup and Zelaya should return rather than the countries of the region. That was a key play, right?
That's right. And in doing that, so this happened, what you're talking about, the IES negotiations, which were set up unilaterally by the United States, by Hillary Clinton, to take place between the usurping Honduran administration, so the dictatorship, Arias, the United States, and Mel Zelaya, which that was in, that directly contradicted the unanimous resolution of the Organization of American States just days previously.
Adrian Pines, I'll play all of it tomorrow. Actually, Dennis Bernstein liked it so much he played it twice this week, so you want to hear the end of it, you know, in the near term, you can go to Flashpoints on SoundCloud. Just look for the Flashpoints channel.